Oh, now it's okay. It's all right now. That was up when I was replaying it back. But I've got 45 minutes in there, and if we decide we want to talk longer, I've got another tape. So that's just one side. So let me just start out, and at first it's going to sound a little formal, but this is Fred Taylor. And Fred, you were born in when? And you were born in Kinston, I guess. And
yeah.
When?
Well, October 1929, actually. The day before Black Friday or what, Thursday or whatever it was. On the stock market collapse,
oh,
I guess, yeah.
You think you triggered that?
My mother says she doesn't remember anything about it, so she had a mind on other things.
Were there any special things in your early life or early education, family connections that sort of led you to studying architecture or coming to the school?
Well, that's a good, interesting question. Not in terms of the family, other than the fact that my mother was, I think, to some extent, visually inclined. I mean, she was interested in, and the house that my parents built, a very simple one, but she went to great lengths to make it into something, you know, fairly rather nice, but given the limited means and so on. And the thing that I do remember is that she subscribed to a magazine, I think it was called American Home or something like mm-hmm. this, and every month they published a house, as those kinds of magazines do. And I became kind of intrigued. Now, this was when I was in maybe the seventh grade in school. I was intrigued by the idea of a plan, you know, yeah. and how this related to the house and so on. And of course, they had the plans for the house that I was living in, so I looked at those one thing or another. But then I do remember that they published not just, I mean, there were all sorts of, frequently, Royal Barry Wills, Cape Cod houses in there, of course, but also Neutra.
Really?
I'm absolutely still stunned. I remember that there was more than one Neutra house published in this thing. And I began to see this as something, you know, and then we had in Kinston at that time, I guess it was only the two architects, which were Mitchell Wooten and Jack Rowan. And Mitchell Wooten is, I'm distantly related through marriage to him. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a relation at all, to tell you the truth, but I mean, my great aunt was a Wooten and was somewhat connected there, I suppose. But anyhow, I never knew him, I never met him. I've forgotten what year he died. It seems to me it was in the early 40s. They had some work, the WPA and things like this they were doing. And he was in New York, and he was a rather flamboyant character and liked to party. And he died in a hotel room after a big fling. And my father was horrified when he found out I was interested in being an architect, because all he could do was associate this experience, and he thought, God, that's the way he's going to end up, you know. But once you've been bitten by the bug, I mean, there's not too much your parents can do to turn it off, I suppose.
Did you know Jack Rowland? Was there a connection there at all?
At that time, no. You see, I mean, they were probably building the courthouse. I've forgotten what year that was. In fact, that was built maybe.
The
that was in the early
30s. Finished, I believe, about 39 or so.
Was it that late?
Yeah, it was late. It was surprisingly late. It might have been a little bit early. I can't.
Well, it may have been, and then I did spend the summer in New York in 39. My father went up to take a course, and my aunt and uncle lived there, and I went with him, and we spent some of my aunt showed me New York when I was 9 years old.
The World's Fair was there that summer.
World's Fair, we went to the World's Fair four or five times, and I remember, you know, some of the things vaguely, but I mean, architecturally, I wasn't that concerned about the building design so much as other features that were
true.
There was an Italian building with this waterfall that was most ghastly, you know, fascist building, but I was very turned on by this waterfall 4 or 5 feet high, and this glass, and you could go inside and get under it. So, well, anyhow, and that grass ain't like it was.
Listen, as long as you've got time, there's no problem.
But anyhow, we went, when I was, as I say, I from the time I was in the seventh grade, I got interested, and I just realized from then I'd never look back. I mean, there was no other alternative.
Fred, I would tell you, you know, just to interject, that during my years as department head, your story is like so many that I've heard, although it's frankly, it's a bit more sophisticated than right much more, because so many of the young people who come and want to talk, they often want to talk with me, or they did when I was department head, about their interest in architecture. And they're all fascinated, they've gotten introduced to architecture through magazines, mm-hmm. and through houses, often going on then to design houses that they sort of dream houses. They often got into courses in school, the drafting courses that they sometimes call architecture courses. But although, often the thing that always surprises me is that something like naming Royal Barry Wills or Richard Neutra, being aware that there was a real difference. Mm-hmm. I mean, to them, my impression that 90% of them is that they were fascinated with the idea of making plans, but nothing, no sense that there was really any difference from one type to another.
Well, yeah. On the other hand, you know, Royal Barry Wills was not the worst.
Oh, no, he was not.
His houses have a character that none of the other junk that was being published at the time
had. No,
no,
I didn't mean that.
It's published today. I know what you mean. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, no, he was a very reputable in his, very well-defined kind of traditional mode. Sure. Most of the things you see in magazines today are just, you know, just standard routine stuff. Sure.
I didn't take any course. There was no course in high school except drafting, and I didn't take it. It was not for college preparatory students. You could take it, but I didn't. But this time I had my own drawing board, and I was learning by on my own, and I just, you know. Mm-hmm. I did actual working drawings. Now, they were very simple in those days, you know. I mean, the kind of thing, just a plan and some elevations. Mm-hmm. But I did a couple of working drawings. I don't think that anything was ever built, but, you know, for people who were seriously about thinking about building. Mm-hmm. And one was a teacher that I forgot about, and she ultimately built something else. I don't think whether I got a price on it or not. But I mean, I was doing drawings and so on, and any project in school that came along, I would. You know, but anyhow. So then I started looking around, thinking, you know, where are you going to go? And there was only two choices that even entered my mind. One was state, and the other was Georgia Tech.
You see, why Georgia Tech?
Well, because that's where Mitchell Wooten and Jack Rowland had been.
You
see, that was the connection.
Okay.
And that, I'm trying to think, when I first I did some work for Rowland. It may have been the summer before I went off to school, and I went there, went through and got the old magazines and did some refiling and threw out things. Not threw out things, but maybe 12 of them. I can't remember. But I did go to their office, and their office. Wooten was long since dead, but Roland was running, and of course, continued to work there. And then what happened, the reason I went to Raleigh was because I got a scholarship to go, and it had to be the University of North Carolina. So. I mean, there was no other choice. That settled it right
there. Had you gone up to talk to
the school? Nothing. But I had heard that they'd done within a department. See, the school was then organized a year before I went there. I ended in 48, and I think it began in 47.
No. They were probably working it out, but the first year that Henley was the dean was 48-49. He really did not get, because I've got a letter, I know that for a fact. He was in the process of being interviewed, and it really.
But Bob, there was somebody there doing something, because Warren Hoggett was ahead of me, and I went to see him before I went. He was the only person I talked to. He was from Princeton.
Yeah, I know. And
Warren. He came back.
He finished the same year I did.
Well, he dropped out. I don't know what happened.
Yeah, he might have gone to Korea or something.
Maybe did. At any rate, he was a year ahead of me in school, and he went up and he. And I heard that he was, and so I called him, and I went around and talked to him. And he had this kind of somewhat cynical attitude about what they were doing at the school, and that these crazy people had come and they were doing. That's why I felt sure that the school was the year before. Wait a minute, let me think. It was 48, fall of 48 that I entered there, because I finished in 53.
Well, he may have observed some of the things that were beginning to happen.
Wait a minute.
The school.
Is that possible? Wait a minute, I finished in 53.
No, this worked out. It was 53, 52, 51, 50, 49. It sounds like you came into a five-year curriculum.
Yeah.
I don't know how to explain that. We'll have to look into that, because I've got, everything that I've ever read said the school started in 48, and Novitsky came there in the fall of 48. Henry might have been on site for a short while, you know, during the spring or something like that, organizing.
I wonder if it wasn't something like
that.
It may well have been that
some of those, you know, that the Oklahoma group came and that they were still dealing under the old structure or something. Honestly,
That may be. He may have just come and maybe he conducted or some had somebody conduct a project or two.
Yeah, it's certainly possible. I'll look into that. I can't tell you for sure.
Well, I mean, it was people ahead of us. Elizabeth Lee was there, you see, as a second-year student when I was there. Have you talked to her?
No.
She's one you ought to talk to.
Well, another person that
she would remember the very beginnings of it.
Well, Herb McKim is a good friend of mine, and I see Herb a lot. He graduated in 50, so he was there at the transition. They had a reunion of the class of 50, and they were... few years ago, and that included the whole Ballard McKim Sawyer group from Wilmington, all three of those guys, and George Qualls came.
Oh my goodness.
And there were a number of others, but they are, some of those people are still around. I can talk with them about it and get more
information. Wait a minute, something's confused there, Bob. George Qualls was in the class of 50.
He was there for the reunion of the class of 50.
He didn't graduate in 50.
Well, he might not have been.
Because I helped him, and when I was a freshman, I'm getting ahead of this, because
okay.
I didn't.
That's all right.
Well, then I'll come to that and say, anyhow, I went up there without ever having gone to the school. Didn't know one thing about it other than what I had heard.
Okay.
Third hand. So.
And you hadn't seen the barracks, so you thought you were going to come to a wonderful building.
And the first year, I was put in the class of Sasha Novitsky, and it was in the barracks, and it was the ground floor of one of the barrack buildings. And we congregated. And the first day, she read a list of materials that we were to acquire for the course, like paper, you know, whatever. I did not understand one word she said. I panicked. I absolutely panicked.
Because her accent?
Her English, it was impossible.
Okay.
I mean, couldn't understand. See, here I was coming from the small town of North Carolina. I'd never been exposed to foreigners that, you know, like that. I mean, I might have been New York, but I mean, they're not, I really had to understand. Did not understand one word she said. And after the class was up, everybody in the class got up and went up to the front, copied the list down, and we were passing it around because nobody else understood her either. And at any rate, it was, you know, I think she was a marvelous first year design critic, finally. I mean, you know, at first it took us a long time, but once you began to understand her and so on, and it was because she simply laid down the law and said, do this and do that, you know, and I mean, we were not given much freedom in that class.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's surprising in a way because she was, would give you the impression that she was sort of at loose ends. I know when it came time to explain how to draw, set a perspective, she called Duncan Stewart in to tell us how, and he left, and she said, that's how it's done. And she had the slightest idea how to do it, and that was the end of that. But anyhow, one thing she did, Matthew would come to the class occasionally. He didn't talk to us then, but he was, I mean, because it was a design studio anyhow. Excuse me.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Eduardo's not coming.
Oh.
He had made other arrangements.
Oh.
All the effort, sorry.
But he finally, he is going to come around 9 o'clock and have a glass of port if we open the port.
Port? In the summer? No.
Well, something. We'll give him some ice water and tell him it's port.
Water.
Well, maybe a little Pepsi Cola and tell him it's port. Not a very high quality port, but nevertheless.
So he was there in and out of the class, and that was not much of an experience with him.
Well, he had fifth year.
Oh, he was teaching fifth year. But he, she would give us a, I remember distinctly once, twice, I can think of two projects, where she gave us an assignment to do, you know, and we'd do a sort of sketch of something, and like a ballet set or a, you know, some sort of very simple design thing, but without any kind of programming. It's just a kind of, you know, sculptural kind of thing. And you do something, and she'd take all these, and then she'd take them home. And the next day she'd come back with, and give everybody one of Matthew's sketches. One of Matthew's sketches of what to do with these things. It makes me sick. I have no idea what became of these things. But he was just like this, you know. He was so fluent. I mean, he would just take this, and he would tell you, you know, and then she'd say, do this. And then you'd develop it, make models of it, and drawings, and so on. And that's how, that's in a way how that she operated for a while. That wasn't every project was done like that.
Do you think that was because she was somewhat lacking in confidence or inexperience at that time, or did she, or that that, I mean, why would she do it that way?
She didn't say that's what was doing. That was what.
No, but
that
I guess
case.
I'm asking.
I mean,
you
I just think when I saw his sketches later, I realized that they were that he had done them.
Uh-huh.
I kind of thought
so,
that she.
So far as you knew,
she didn't
they,
say. She didn't say who had done them.
Okay.
And I could be wrong. I mean, I really never saw her work directly. I say work. I mean, in the verb sense. I didn't see her sit down with a pencil and sketch. But there, thinking, I mean, when I remember them, they were too much like his sketches not to have been his, and I feel sure that they were. I don't know why she, in a sense, you know, I thought maybe she was, well, perhaps inexperienced in teaching, and that she felt, you know.
Well, she was in a new world, new country within
that,
the language.
And then she wanted, I think the other thing is she wanted, she had, of course, I mean, utmost faith in him, and she wanted us to have the best, and he was right there. Maybe, who knows what went on at home.
Yeah.
She might have brought him home and said, well, these are things he may have, maybe he was like Eduardo, we don't know, maybe he grabbed them up and said, I'll do them, and wouldn't let her do them, you see. I mean, that would, how Eduardo would have done it, right?
Yeah,
because
they'd been doing it.
There's another, yeah. There's another story we'll come to later on about that. But anyhow, we went through the year that way, and the barracks, of course. I mean, everybody will tell you this, as you well know, is it was a great, it was the most marvelous place to have the school, because you could just do anything and didn't care. If the model was too big to get through the door, you just cut a larger door, a hole in the side of the wall, and moved it out. And if painting turned over on the upstairs with Jim Fitzgibbon's class, and it ran down through the cracks onto your thing. It was that was just part of it, of the real world. I mean, it was not a, it was, I don't think, you know, finally, I never really resented the barracks. I resented the Quonset huts where math was taught, and there was a potbelly stove at one end, and freezing cold mornings you'd go in there, and you would just, you know, the heat was all at one end, and that, but that wasn't school, that was stated, that was not.
Let me just interject a minute. Who were some of your classmates? Was Jim Washburn among them?
Jim Washburn was in that class, and we became friends right away somehow.
It was Ralph Knowles in it?
No. Ralph came later.
A year
he was not in that class.
Okay.
That first year, I think Aaron Allred was in that class.
Okay, I know him.
There weren't too many. Now, wait a minute, I can't recall whether Charles Savinfield was or not. He wasn't, later he was in, certainly. I think Savinfield was in Duncan's section. See, Sasha had one section, Duncan had a section, and somebody else had it. There were at least three sections of freshman design, I believe. And I don't remember who the third one was.
Okay.
At any rate, we didn't see too much of Henry. But there was another feature that I mentioned George Qualls, and that was that she had us go and help fifth-year students when they were on charrette. So that to come, you know, to get, that's another thing that isn't, I don't know, I suppose it's common in most schools, but I don't believe it happens at MIT, where everything is so isolated that one class doesn't know what the other is doing.
I don't think it happens hardly anymore.
But they are, the freshmen, were immediately, I mean, we were forced. I mean, you weren't just, you go, you know. And I remember making trees for a model of the thing that George Qualls had designed. And I remember the design, it was two barrel vaults. I don't remember what it was for, but I remember it. And everybody was making, oh, as Sasha says, the Strasbourg model.
Strasbourg.
We had to do everything on Strasbourg. That was the easiest of all the words she came up with. But anyhow.
Were you taking other design classes, like design, I don't know, any kind of drawing classes or history or anything like that?
Not history. You know, we must have been taking a drawing course, but I can't recall who would have taught it. Oh, me.
Do you have
one of the early, the original catalogs?
Catalogs, and they had
the thing with the cover that's sort of
right. And it has this wonderful curriculum diagram overlaid on a kind of a tree that that showed that. And one of the things, the features, Eduardo didn't seem to recall much about it, but one of the features of that curriculum that certainly was in place when I got there in 52 was that for every year of design, every studio in design, you also had a parallel course in what they call descriptive drawing.
Right.
And the first couple of years, it was rather directed. They were teaching you freehand drawing, you did various things, or in some cases, more technical type of drawing. And then later on, when you got to, as I recall, third year, you began to do essentially art. I mean, painting and sculpture and whatever.
Yeah.
I remember one semester I built a ceramic top coffee table.
Oh, yes.
Lou Tavelli?
Tavelli.
Well, he wasn't, in my particular case, wasn't there, but Tavelli's been mentioned. I know he's one that Harry Ellen's wife was very liked very much. Eduardo liked him.
Lou Tavelli was a marvelous fellow. I mean, he was a real artist.
Yes, that's what everybody says.
I think he was a true artist.
Do you want to kind of go on through sort of chronologically? Just sort of hit the high points or whatever.
I don't remember that one had any choice. I mean, I certainly had no choice. I wouldn't have known who to choose anyhow. Yeah. I'd listened to Sasha and Duncan Stewart and something, whoever was teaching the other section, didn't say anything. I would never have chosen Sasha's course for fear I couldn't get anything out of it. The next year, I landed in George Matsumoto's design course. He was teaching second year. I can't tell you who was teaching the other year, but isn't all that recorded somewhere? There must be a...
Probably. I can probably dig that out. I'm not really looking for that. Sure. I'm really looking for more your personal experiences.
The first project there was the Primitive Shelter. Mm-hmm. Is that what it was called?
Yeah, Primitive Shelter, yeah.
And I think we were assigned locations. I had Yuma, Arizona, and it was a desert climate. I was certainly kind of disappointed. I've been drawing house for years and suddenly, I mean, the first year was one thing because that, was really learning new techniques of drawing, making models and, the so-called learning to do perspective. But really, Sasha introduced you to, it was really the European, I felt, the European elegance in design that somehow, I might have been aware, but I mean, she kept using the word good, like Nice used to say, I don't want to be interesting, I want to be good. And the word good meant, something very special. It wasn't just to do something that was interesting or clever or whatever, but that was what she really imparted, I think, more than anything else. And it was probably through Matthew,
Let me ask you this, because I think I know the answer, but this was not what one would describe as a sort of Bauhaus introduction to design process and principles. I don't know how familiar you are, but if you read anything about the Bauhaus, everything was done on a kind of non-objective basis. Yeah. I mean, they dealt with bending metal, they worked with various metals or materials.
No, as a matter of fact, we weren't introduced to that. We didn't learn anything.
Compositional principles that were abstract, total. Well, that later, I have to say, Roy Gusso, when I had him 4 years later, I think we've got an extremely straightforward version of,
yeah, right,
the Bauhaus method and ideas.
Sure.
I mean, not exactly, but it, from everything I know about the Bauhaus, Roy, who'd been a student of Moholy, really kind of took us through the paces, and we did a little bit, you know, everything.
Now, Roy Gusso was a marvelous, and unfortunately, I never worked with him on anything else. I mean,
he came through for us later.
Yeah, but I mean, not even in, I regret that, I really do, because I think he had so much to offer. Yeah. I mean, you know, when things at the time, I thought Sasha was the best you could have, George Matsumoto was the most marvelous second-year student, teacher, instructor you could hope to have, because houses, that's when you got into it,
yeah.
I mean, that was his fort.
And he loved, he always gave houses to do.
Yeah, and then the thing is, that was the other thing was the terribly exciting thing was happening, is that they were building, Henry was building his house.
Yeah, that's right.
And George Fitzgibbons, I mean, Jim Fitzgibbons was doing the Fatum House and the Pascal House.
Yeah.
And then George was building others. He was doing the...
one of the earlier ones that he did was the Richard House.
That's the Richard House. I had a... I had, for years, I had a copy of the blueprints for that house.
I've got the plans of a lot of his, but not of that one. He sent us a set of about 16 working drawings.
Uh-huh.
It's a roll of drawings about this big.
I'm sorry, I don't have that. I tell you, a lot of things I had rolled up in my mother's, and when I was in India and came back, I found that they'd got, I don't remember, they were damaged, I think in Bellevue or something. They'd been back in an old closet or somewhere, and I just had to throw all that stuff out. It was a shame. Anyhow, George, second year, and it was, well, then you really began feeling much, I think I felt more in the second year than in the first, that the class, the group, as a kind of, almost like a club. I mean, we were at the studio working at night together. There was some of that in freshman year. But in second year, we were already in, what was the building?
Daniels?
Daniels. Second year was in Daniels. Hmm. And we had, in fact, that corner drafting room, windows on two sides, the one when you came up the step, next to Henry's office. And you felt, you know, somehow we were all there working, as I say, it was a group. George would come there nearly every night. He wasn't married at the time, didn't have a family. He would be there frequently, not maybe every night, but frequently. So that the class went on. It wasn't just, you know, something happened from 2 to 4 in the afternoon or 2 to 6 or whatever it was. It was, you know. And of course, I think nearly everybody will say, well, you always learn more from your fellow students. You do learn a lot, but you learn. You've got to have, in that stage, some direction too, I think. And that's, and George was, I mean, that's when we were introduced to Mies van der Rohe, you see, and you know, really what are the, you know, what is all that about? I mean, I can't tell you, I feel sure Charlie Sappenfield was in the class at about that time. I'm pretty sure he was with Duncan the first year, and I don't remember whether there were how many sections in the second year, maybe there were only two, or maybe there was Georgia, the whole thing. Henry was not, I mean, he was there, but I mean, you didn't study with him, you didn't really get to know him.
I never got to know him until the fifth year, barely then.
And what else?
Well, the end of that year, or the beginning of the next year, was when Novitzky.
That's right.
It was end
of the year.
I think it was
Washburn came down and visited me. We went to my cousin's cottage in Moorhead. And one morning we were there, and you know, my mother was there, and my sister, and we were staying in this cottage, and we went and picked up a paper and saw this in the paper, and it was a bombshell, because Jim Washburn also was very close to Sasha, and he felt, you know, very, it was not just a class thing. I remember going with her somehow and things, and I can't recall exactly what, whether, now I remember, that first year they had the Knowles, Hans and, what's her name? No, Florence Knowles. Come down to Raleigh. They had a show of all that furniture in Raleigh.
That's amazing.
That was the third. That was the first year.
I've never heard of that. That's interesting.
And
I. They had a show. What do you mean a show?
Of their furniture.
I know, but where?
I don't remember.
But it was somewhere on the campus.
No. It was downtown Raleigh.
Okay.
Somewhere.
Okay.
It wasn't a museum. I think they thought maybe it was a commercial thing. They were trying, but they probably. I'm sure it was some of Henry's organization that he had encouraged it will come down. You know, we're building these modern houses. You introduce, you show your work. Nobody that has the slightest idea what a well-designed chair is.
Mm-hmm.
They probably, you know, brought some of their best things, including things that she, because she did a lot of the design, Florence Knowles.
Mm-hmm.
But she and Sasha were like this, of course. They had that feeling of, you know. And I remember that we went with her to see the furniture and all, and she, you know, said, There was something other than just the kind of thing. I mean, this was completely extracurricular,
yeah.
Outside the school.
Sure.
And yet it was instigated by Henry, I'm sure. And I mean, it was like building the houses. It was another thing that fired up the excitement and enthusiasm of students. Because you could see it wasn't just something you're doing on paper. Here it was happening. And it was also new that they had to bring people from New York to do this because it... And so you felt you were part of the part of the beginning of the modern movement, which had gone on for 50-60 years by then. But anyhow.
Well, when you came back to the school for the third year, there was that change with Nowitzki having been killed.
He was gone, and they were trying to find somebody. They were having other people come. I went into the third year, and in the first semester, I had Wiseman? What's his name? I forgot. I can see him there.
I think there was a Wiseman, although
Wiseman.
He was not there by the time I got there.
Yeah, he was just in a year or two. But I was in his section, the first, and Fitzgibbon later.
Okay.
So I didn't have Jim the whole third year. But I had George the whole second year. Of course, we've won three terms too. That
That's
was the only
right.
Wasn't semester was
three
quarters.
Quarters.
Well, anyhow, Sasha, you know, we saw her because she was still around the school and all, and she was trying to get adjusted one thing and another. It was an actual extremely extraordinary difficult time for her. She was pregnant, you see, when he died with the second child. The second child was born after he was killed, and so there she was with this infant.
And teaching.
And she kept on teaching, yes. I don't know how she did that. I may be wrong. She may not have talked for, I think she must have. Because I remember her coming to our class once when I was, you know, was starting with the Wiseman, and that was the first semester of the third year.
Mm-hmm.
She
might have taken
a
quarter off or something.
It's possible. Then, and they were having people, I can't think of who they are now. Shemaev came. He was one they were considering. I didn't have anything much to do with him. I mean, it was, you know. But going back to the first year, of course, the other thing I've left out is that one day Sasha said something very special is happening next week. And this wonderful person is coming to lecture.
I bet I can guess
who
it is already. Bucky.
Bucky Fuller. Well, we all went to listen to Bucky Fuller, of course, and he talked to him.
But
until we
were
all fast asleep, practically. He kept on lecturing for days. But that was a whole new, I mean, that was he really injected it. Wherever he went, I remember when at MIT years later, when I was here as a student, and they had visiting people come in, again, work with us, but there was always Andy and Kevin Lynch who were running the class. And I don't know how it was that Bucky came, because he would You know, he came and worked with a group that was maybe not the whole, I'm not sure what the whole place, but the first day he was there, it was just like somebody, like a shot in the arm, the whole class, you know, just, and I remember Anderson saying, you know, wherever Bucky is, it's always this tremendous lift.
Mm-hmm.
And it was true, he had that. And the other person, of course, was Louis Mumford.
That's right.
Who arrived from the beginning, and who was like, well, he was the godfather, I kept thinking. Not in the mafia sense, but in the true sense of he was a godfather of the school in a way, because he was, I assume, was the one responsible for getting the
disc. Well, now, tell me, what do you remember exactly what he did? Did he give a course? Did he just give a series of lectures?
Seminars. There were seminars mostly, mm-hmm. in which he talked.
How much time would he be there? He wasn't really in residence for a long period of time.
No, but he would. He wasn't there for just a day or two. Okay. He would come and
spend a couple of weeks or something?
I think so. I have the impression it was something like a couple of weeks. It was not a whole semester, certainly, and it wasn't just for 2 or 3 days the way Meese and these other people did. And Bucky, of course, came and spent time,
too. It was
usually
a month, as I recall.
Yeah,
he would do a real project.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, in the beginning, it wasn't. Okay. In the beginning, you see, he came and just lectured and had all these models of these geometric models that he was, and sketches on the drawing board and all that kind of thing. And he didn't really work. It was in our fourth year that we did the cotton mill.
Okay.
And that, I think, was the first, no, maybe not, no, because he was doing work before that. There were projects, there were building models, certainly. Of things. I think it's in our third year that one morning, on a weekend, we all went somewhere, somebody's backyard, and they had all this lath cut up and drilled, and we were going to build a dome. And it started, and you got about the third connection you could put together. So they took a new drill and made new holes. I mean, and of course, the whole thing went completely wrong. And the next one, I mean, that was a very important lesson, because then you realized how precise these things had to be, and you just couldn't play around with them.
This kind of influx of all of these people, you began to be aware of it really at the very beginning.
Oh, right? Yeah, and it started from the first year.
Yeah.
It started from the first year, and the others that came, like Meese was there, what, 2 or 3 days? Well, you must have been there.
I was there with Meese.
He was only there 2 or 3 days, and Frank Lloyd Wright also. But I mean, what an incredible impression that, you know, these people made. I mean, I can't overestimate the importance of that kind of thing. And it's very odd, because of course they had to be people whom you knew about to be able to make that, so dynamic in their work and in their method of working with the students that it would make that kind of impression. But of course, when Meese came, you knew his work. You knew what he stood for. You didn't have to listen to him. You just see them.
Mm-hmm.
It's God before you know. And Wright the same way. I mean, when Wright was there, of course it was this, I mean, we felt we were the top dogs in the country, because who else had Frank Wright come in from Georgia Tech and everywhere all over the Southeast, you know, came to this lecture. And
how do you think Henry persuaded him to come along?
I cannot imagine.
I've got to look up, and I've got Henry's, I mean, I have access to Henry's files. I hope that there's a good bit of documentation in the files with letters maybe back and forth and something setting that up, and Henry,
so.
It's going to be real interesting to see if Henry says, well, Mr. Wright, we've got this all arranged, and we're going to have this big place for you, and I can assure you it's going to be great. I don't know, but I'm real curious about that particular one.
Yeah. All I remember was that I don't recall which day what happened, but there was the lecture one night, and then the next day it was announced that, you know, Mr. Wright would speak. Oh, gosh, I've forgotten the names of the halls now. This is one that's, I don't even remember where it was. One of the older buildings on the campus, and, you know, near Brooks and so on. Anyhow,
Pullen, it might have been.
It wasn't Pullen. No, I remember Pullen. It wasn't Pullen. Maybe it was they had scheduled it for Pullen. That was it, they had scheduled it for Pullen.
When they moved it out.
And Wright refused. He took one look at the hall, and when everybody got there, they said, no, he's going to talk to you out in the lawn under the trees. Well, we went there, and of course, people as close as you and I could hear him, and nobody else could understand a word he was saying.
But this was in addition to his major address over in the
Coliseum. Yeah, this was just for us. This was just for the school, just for the School of Design. And I remember Henry kind of pacing the thing, right, walking around. He was very unhappy because he knew that nobody could hear him. But finally, he said, I guess that he had sensed this would happen, and I came over and said, Mr. Wright, I'm sorry, but really no one can hear you here because of the background noise and so on. And we've got another hall, which I think should be okay. And you've got, it's just a gaslit point. You can imagine, I don't remember what the hall running at. At that, it was just like a stampede. Everybody got up and ran to this other hall, to get as close as possible. Jumping over anything. It was like a... that was just demonstration of enthusiasm that people had. Of course, it was Frank Lloyd Wright. But anyhow, he then talked. I don't remember anything he said.
He'd made his point about the hall, didn't he? So he went ahead and did it in the real place.
So then that night we heard that Henry was having him at his house with the senior class, the 50th class, and maybe the 40th class. What year was he there? Now this is
1950.
50.
It was May. It was a late spring.
We would have a look at spring.
It was right around May, if I'm not mistaken, May or June. It was late.
50.
No, it couldn't have been June.
A second. Yes, I can't believe that. Third or fourth year, but I must.
This I know because I've looked at the poster and everything.
Well, all I remember is that Sherman Body. So Sherman was in the class the second year, and Bruno Leon was in the George's class the second
year.
They had come. They were transfer students. Yeah. They had come. So they were there, and Sherman and Washburn and I crashed the party. We went out to him's. I don't know how we got out. I think Washburn had a car. We drove out there. And they were all there. And we went up and knocked on the door. And Henry came, scared to death what he would say. And of course, he was very gracious. He just smiled. He was delighted, I think, that we were. Of course, he couldn't have the whole school, but that we wanted to come so badly that we would do that, I think he felt. So. We went in, and I remember sitting on the floor, and he was sitting right there. I don't remember a word he said, but it was part of the aura of the school and the excitement and the kind of thing that was something else just crossed my mind. I was talking about that, and I can't think of it coming in a minute.
Well, there's a famous story about something that Pardew's name came up, and Wright called to have Pardew delivered or sent or something like that. Henry has always told me that story. Now I don't know what he's, and I can't remember the details of it, but something about
I don't remember that. No, what I remember was that when George Nelson was there, that it was at a time that Sherman had some affair with a girl, and I think she was pregnant or something, and there was this thing going on. Mm-hmm. And of course Henry got into the midst of it. And must have said something to Nelson, and then at Flat Five one night, Nelson and Sherman got into a long discussion. I don't know. I don't remember. Maybe there was something to write, but I just don't. See, we were second. Steve, I would find that hard to.
Doesn't make sense.
It doesn't
fit
with the second year.
It doesn't.
Now, Sherman and Bruno used to get into great arguments in the drafting room, because they were sort of philosophical arguments, mm-hmm. and it was, the other thing that would happen at that time that was not so true later on was not only did we begin to get transfer students, because this was very important. See, the first year we were all, it was a very provincial school because we were all mostly from North Carolina. There was one fella in our freshman class, he didn't survive, who was a football player. He'd been brought in from Michigan or somewhere. How he ended in architecture. He was recently, I do remember that he was somewhat talented, but he had no time. He was on the playing field all the time, and poor fella just couldn't do the two things. But other than that, we were all basically local kids in a sense, and but because the word of the school began to get around, second, third, well, I mean, why did Bruno Leon come today? See, and Sherman had been in Virginia, of course, that was close by, and he had heard about it. Well, the word got around, and then, and of course, the fact that Frank Lloyd Wright was there put the school on the map. I mean, there's no question in terms of the architecture of schools around the country.
Was Novitzky's reputation such that people knew? I mean, was he? I mean, I know he wasn't world famous at that time, and the arena had not really been built. But there was there anything like that that also attracted people, or was his reputation the result really of the building of the arena and subsequent design work that was published and Mumford's sort of celebration of him and so forth?
I don't know. Would guess the latter. Yeah. I don't think that he was that well known before.
Okay.
I mean, he wouldn't have been as well known as Shemaiah, for example.
No, probably not.
I mean, he had been on the committee for the UN, you know,
right,
business,
right.
But I mean, I don't think.
He wouldn't have been known to students.
I certainly didn't ever heard of him until I got there. And of course, then I was promptly told that he was the most wonderful thing that ever happened, and I believed it, but I mean, it wasn't.
T.C. Howard has told me one kind of amusing thing. I only remember it in a general way, but he was saying that sometime, one time he observed him, Mumford was giving a lecture, and apparently in the drafting room.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know.
Well, that's very possible.
And he was talking about something, and he says that Novitzky apparently sensed that either the message was not getting over or was not clearly expressed or something, and he kind of insinuated himself and sort of came in and almost took over and started illustrating.